Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump on nukes, terror in Berlin, Aleppo is Assad's, North Carolina's bathroom bill remains. This morning, President-elect Trump doubled down on his tweet about expanding U.S. nuclear weapons capability with MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski.
The president-elect told you what?
Let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass.
And outlast them all.
A big rig tore through a Christmas market in Berlin, many dead, including now the attacker. Here was German Chancellor Angela Merkel first responding.
Meine Damen und Herren, dies ist ein sehr schwerer Tag.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very difficult day. I am, like millions of people in Germany, shocked, devastated.
And North Carolina's legislature failed to repeal HB 2, known as the bathroom bill on gender and toilets. The state's governor-elect Roy Cooper hit out.
The legislature had a chance to do the right thing for North Carolina, and they failed.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kathy Gilson and Sahil Kapoor and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on Trump and nukes, Berlin, Aleppo, North Carolina? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from St. Louis is Kathy Gilson, senior editor at The Atlantic, home for the holidays. Kathy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks.
And from Washington, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Sahil, welcome back to you as well.
It's a pleasure to be back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kathy, and Sahil.
Can we go straight to Donald Trump's comments this morning on Morning Joe? We heard them at the top of the hour there. Apparently, he was talking off-air in a break with Mika Brzezinski and said this, all this about... you heard it. You know, here we go. Bring it. Kind of a bring it on statement. We heard Joe Scarborough asking, "What did he say?" And Brzezinski saying, "Let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass, and outlast them all." Now, this comes, Kathy Gilson, after a tweet earlier in the week where he had talked about expanding American nuclear capability. What terrain are we on with the president-elect here?
Right. So that tweet yesterday caused a lot of consternation, but as often is the case with Donald Trump's tweets, it's also caused a lot of contradictory analysis and contradictory statements coming out of the Trump campaign. You had Kellyanne Conway on Rachel Maddow's show last night trying to play down what might actually be new about this, and it is true that the Obama administration has committed to investing $1 trillion over the next 30 years to modernize the American nuclear arsenal. So the big question is whether Trump intends to actually invest in getting more warheads, which is something that the United States and Russia actually negotiated not to do. And there was some speculation that this came in response to remarks Putin had made, again, about the need to have a strong nuclear capability. So while Trump's advisors were playing this tweet down yesterday, and in fact, while Vladimir Putin was playing down the remarks in his year-end news conference saying, you know, we don't want escalation. Then Trump went on Morning Joe and threw things into disarray yet again. So hard to know which message to listen to, but I would say that Trump should be taken seriously on his own terms.
Sahil Kapoor, there is a tradition of very, very careful speech when it comes to nuclear weapons. After all, the stakes could not be higher. The tweet clearly said expand its nuclear capability. Now, that was a broad, rough way of saying modernize, but expanding is different than modernizing. Of course, then you get into all the language of nuclear agreements, which are very solemn agreements. What struck me was he had a Trump spokesman came out early, Jason Miller, saying that he wasn't talking about an arms race at all, that he was in fact referring to the threat of nuclear proliferation and the need to prevent it. Though that seems very hard to read into the actual words of that tweet. And then, Sahil, this morning, I mean, whatever the Trump handlers are saying here, we have him quoted by a prominent American journalist saying, let it be an arms race. This is not this gets interpreted abroad, whatever the sort of fine-tuning they try to do later here at home, doesn't it, Sile?
Right. Trump's team and Trump's tweets don't seem to be completely on the same page here. And I think the overarching question when it comes to the issue of nuclear proliferation, which is obviously an enormously important one, but also all the other things that Trump is going to be handling on a foreign policy level, the question is how much muscle does he put behind what he says? I think on a major level, all presidencies on a foreign policy level will be a reaction to their predecessors. And Trump looks at Obama and thinks of someone who has been too cautious, who has done things like put out a red line in Syria that he didn't follow through. And I think he's trying to send the message to adversaries, to people around the world, don't you dare test me. It remains to be seen whether he follows through with this. But you're absolutely right that words can have an enormous impact on a foreign policy level, you know, in much the same way that President Obama looked to his predecessor, George W. Bush, and said, this is what happens when you do something too bold and brazen, and you end up with the disaster in Iraq, which more than anything else made him president. So I think Trump is signaling that he's going to make a major shift. The contours of that remain to be seen.
Jack Beatty, there has been so much over the many months of campaigning, waving off of flamboyant statements by Donald Trump. But now here we are. We are less than a month away from him being commander-in-chief, from him being president of the United States. And this kind of what looks to me like shoot from the hip commentary on nuclear weapons, this to me, I do not recall a precedent for.
No, you almost have to go to Nikita Khrushchev
mm-hmm.
at the UN, where he said, we will bury you. I mean, this is almost at that level of extremity. You know, during the campaign, Tom, we talked about it on the show, a group of, I think, 50 former national security people from Republican administrations came out with an open letter saying, be afraid, be very afraid if Trump is elected, because by reasons of his lack of knowledge, his temperament, his judgment, he's not suited for the job. Well, this is kind of evidence of that. This is unsuitable presidential behavior or pre-presidential behavior. And his team has got to understand that we're not in the campaign anymore. You know, in the campaign, he used these tweets, often incendiary, often sometimes even appalling, as bright, shiny objects to sort of distract the press from what was happening right then, from current stories he didn't want focused on. That doesn't work in international affairs at all. And they've got to cure him of that habit, or we're all going to be in trouble.
Well, Jack, you say unsuitable, but maybe, as Kathy suggests, this is a kind of repositioning of the United States, and Sile as well, repositioning vis-a-vis other countries around the world, sort of brushing back, saying, you know, new sheriff in town is going to be different.
Yes, but the other countries are players in this as well, and they can react to these things not as, oh, that's just Trump repositioning. They can actually take him literally, and then where will we be? Look what's happened with China, with his questioning of the bedrock of U.S.-Chinese relations, one China policy. He suddenly has put that on the table almost as a bargaining chip. This is, yes, it's disruptive, but to what end? I mean, chaos is not a policy.
Kathy, when I hear let it be an arms race, and I think of all the work that has gone in for so many years into nonproliferation, and rather successfully, I mean, numbers have come down, this could be a green light for all kinds of new development. What about the Trump team coming in? Do you see a team assembling around him that is likely to increasingly communicate and make the fabric of more cautious or at least sober foreign policy?
I don't exactly see that. I think that the great hope among the foreign policy establishment in D.C. has been James Mattis, who's a very well-respected figure coming in as Secretary of Defense. So he would have a say over these kinds of issues. And I also have to say that, you know, as many things with Trump, a tweet is not a policy necessarily. Policies require investments of resources. Nuclear weapons are very expensive. There's likely to be a lot of institutional resistance within the Pentagon under James Mattis, which tends to like to invest more in conventional capabilities than nuclear capabilities. So he does face some hurdles to shooting off the hip in this way, particularly when it comes to large systems like the military and slow-moving bureaucracies like the military. On the other hand, as we discussed on the show previously, you also have some less conventional advisors on the line of, say, General Michael Flynn, who was by Obama pushed out of the Defense Intelligence Agency for being a bit too freewheeling and has made some inflammatory statements about Islam. So it's not clear that Trump's advisors are necessarily going to have a moderating effect on some of his more inflammatory positions. And indeed, perhaps he's been choosing his advisors to sort of reinforce this worldview that he's already articulated.
Let's go quickly to our callers. Paul in Iowa, Story City, Iowa. Paul, you're on the air.
Well, yes, Tom. I'm a independent voter and a history nut who tries to separate fact from opinion, okay?
Okay.
But the fact is that we're about to be governed by people who hate government, okay? And if the vegetarians have taken over the packing houses, there's not going to be much meat. One thing that comforts me when the wide breadth of history is that little progress occurs when conservative thinking prevails. And another principle is that the people who own the White House yet generally lose in the midterm elections, okay?
You're looking down the road already. Paul, let us grab it before we get to a break here. Hate government. Sahil, does that apply to the Trump core? Donald Trump has said a lot of things that would require government, Social Security and so on. Do you see a hate government impulse here in the nuclear comments?
I don't. I think Trump's party, certainly the party that he ran with, has been an anti-government party for a long time. But his nomination was a repudiation of that party in many ways, and his election was a repudiation of the entire political system. I think on a foreign policy level, Trump's vision is very broad, just some sort of nationalism and this belief that we have to put our resources and time and energy into building America. If anyone tries to come after us, we'll bomb them and take their oil. Beyond that, there's not an intellectual core, so I think a lot of it remains to be seen. I think a lot of it will depend on circumstance and where his mind is at any point.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Nuclear bravado. The Berlin terror suspect killed. Aleppo, rebel held, has fallen. An ambassador shot. Of course, the Russian ambassador in Turkey. An Ebola vaccine. And bathroom bill politics in North Carolina. Sahil Kapoor is with us. He is national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, joining us today from Washington. Kathy Gilson is here, senior editor at The Atlantic, follows global affairs. She's joining us today from St. Louis. Jack Beatty's here. And you can join us. What do you think of the president-elect on nukes just today saying, let it be an arms race? And how are you processing this week's other shockers, the Christmas market attack in Berlin, the shooting of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, Aleppo's contested areas evacuated, now what? And what's up with North Carolina's wild politics? Of course, earlier in the week, we saw that big rig plow into the Christmas market in Berlin, many dead there. Here's a statement from German Chancellor Angela Merkel made after the truck plowed in there, killing 12. She talked about Germany moving forward. ISIS has since claimed to have inspired the attack.
She
says, we don't want to live with the fear of evil paralyzing us, even if that's difficult right now. We will find the force to live the life we want to live in Germany, free, together, and open. Kathy Gilson, at this point, do we understand better the origins of this attack? Is the ISIS claim to have, is it inspired or directed the attack, credible?
I think we're seeing, this is a question that we always have in the wake of attacks in which ISIS claims on social media after the fact, releasing very few additional details beyond what's known to the public. If they released more details, we would have a better sense that perhaps they were involved, the central leadership was somehow involved in planning or executing the attack. What we do know now, the suspect has been killed, so we won't have a chance to interrogate him about what happened. But ISIS's official news channels did release a video of him swearing allegiance to the so-called caliphate. this is consistent with previous attacks in Germany that fortunately did not kill people other than the attackers. In July, you had two attacks. One was a stabbing attack on a train, and another was a suicide attack, a suicide bombing outside of a concert hall, I believe. And in both of those cases, ISIS claimed responsibility, and in both of those cases, there were videos released later of the attackers swearing allegiance to the caliph. So these are attacks that are seen by the German Interior Minister has called these attacks by, quote, remote control. They're somewhere on the spectrum of being directed and inspired. They're in between, because in all of these cases that we've seen, the attacker has been in contact via social media with ISIS operatives. So it's not exactly that they're not connected to the central body of ISIS at all, but it's also not necessarily the case that these are complex conspiracies that of the kind that we've seen in Paris and Belgium, which do tend to kill a lot more people.
130 in Paris, 80 in Nice, also with a truck. Brussels, 32. Here, a dozen, but tragic, and got a lot of politics roiling there as well. I mean, Jack Beattie, however it's directed, there's such a dramatic quality to this these days. That hijacked a Polish freight truck full of steel, and the cousin of the driver who was ultimately tragically shot, the Polish driver, somehow it looks as though this Anas Amrin, we don't know the whole story here, but somebody got up in that cab, took over. The driver's cousin was following this with the, you know, geolocation. The erratic movement of the truck looked like a beginner was trying to drive it, but knew well enough, Jack, to take it into the heart of a Christmas market by that famous bombed-out remains of the church in Berlin. Political ramifications here for the continent as populist right-wing parties point at this and say, okay, there you go.
Yes, and you know, just to narrow in on the attacker, his past history, he was known to the Germans. He was known as a risk. Robert Siegel had an interview the other day talking about how the Germans wanted to send him back to Tunisia. Tunisia wouldn't accept him, and he was sort of in a bureaucratic limbo. He wasn't detained, but he was sort of on the loose. And so it's another one of those cases where the security services actually, you know, had their man, and for various reasons, some of them historically inflected and unique to Germany. This wouldn't have happened, I suppose, in France, where they have a much tougher state system. He was on the loose, but you put your finger on the real trouble here. This is a threat to, you know, to Angela Merkel, and really a threat to the center not holding in Europe. She is the center. And her re-election her election campaign coming up, a lot is going to depend on that. And, of course, that's apt to be interfered with by the Russians. The right-wing party there may well get into the national legislature. It's already in several of the states. Even if she wins, she may have difficulty forming a new coalition. And she is Europe. It is a very disturbing and threatening moment for all who want stability in Europe.
In terms of a cohesive Europe, I mean, sympathy for German police. I saw a German police commander saying, look, there are like 600 plus people that, of this sort of tier that we could or should be following. We just don't have the capacity to follow all of them. Donald Trump weighing on this very briefly, I think, as he was headed out of Trump Tower here in the lobby, just a brief appearance, and he was asked whether the attack in Berlin would cause him to reevaluate his proposals to create a registry of Muslims or to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. The sound quality here is pretty tough, but listen, this is we don't have a press conference. We've got this.
You know my plans all along, and I've been proven to be right, 100% correct. What's happening is disgraceful.
You've known my plans all along, and I've been proven to be right, 100% correct. What's happening is disgraceful. Sal Kapoor, what are the plans that we've known all along from Donald Trump when it comes to immigration and Muslims?
Tom, Donald Trump campaigned on a very restrictionist platform on immigration, whether it's cracking down on illegal immigration, whether it's going after legal immigration and limiting visa programs. It was a pretty across-the-board restrictionist policy. And with regard to Muslim immigration, this has confused a number of people because back in December of 2015, he came out with a rather unorthodox proposal where he said he's going to impose a complete and total shutdown of all Muslim immigration to the United States, even Muslims entering as visitors. Then he later shifted after people raised constitutional questions and people said this is completely antithetical to the free and open society we live in and freedom of religion, the First Amendment, and so on. Then he shifted that to saying, well, we're going to look at territory now, right? So he said, I'm going to impose a shutdown of people coming in from places like Iraq and Syria and Libya, where he argued that we cannot properly vet them. So he's promised to do what he calls extreme vetting from certain countries. But the important thing is he's never disavowed his Muslim ban. And that's kind of what that question was getting to. He correctly said, you know my plans all along, quote unquote. I checked his website just 2 days ago. The Muslim ban proposal is still on there. So, you know, this is not something that he's disavowed. This is not something that people should necessarily assume he won't do. As for the registry, that's a different question. I don't think he specifically put that in writing or proposed that, but there are people around him who certainly have.
Daniel in St. Albans, Vermont. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and happy holidays and Merry Christmas to you and your panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. So let me just start by saying I'm an Iraq and Afghan vet. So I've seen firsthand, you know, the struggle of civilians caught in the middle of a conflict where they have no choice but to hopefully live or hope they don't die. I mean, I'm not sure how else to put that. But so I guess I'm saying I'm for a more open border system. I agree with vetting people, but some of the things that Trump is saying is just outright ridiculous. I mean,
like what, Daniel? I mean, people don't want to live in a situation where they just have to hope they don't die. People like some kind of security. On the other hand, what's ridiculous?
Well, understandable. I mean, I totally don't want to live in a society where I have to look over my shoulder every second. But at the same time, I mean, we've got groups in the United States and countries around the world that are homegrown that do things that we shrug it off. Let me say that. We shrug it off. We just go, oh, it's just one guy. It's not a big deal. But one guy from another country comes here and causes an attack, and all of a sudden it's the end of the world.
Yeah. I mean, it can't feel too good in Berlin, but I must say, in general, the commentary I've heard from Germans has been sort of along this line. We value our freedoms, and we don't want to give everything up to prevent this. On the other hand, no one's happy to have it. Daniel, I appreciate your call. One more right here on this front. Dayton, Ohio. Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think my comment is basically this, is that focus on ISIS for each one of these lone wolf attacks and massive reactions to them accomplishes exactly the terrorist goal, which is to force democratic free societies to become more and more authoritarian, to clamp down on their own citizens in ways that create unrest.
Are you worried about that happening here in this country, Jim?
I think we're seeing it right now. I think the results of our current election are a symptom of that. This incredible terror of any foreigner who comes from an Islamist-based religious tradition is exactly that.
Jim, we've got it, and we'll see soon enough how it plays out in a Trump administration. Donald Trump saying, you know my policy. Got so much news to get to this week. There was the dramatic shooting of the Russian ambassador to Turkey. And, Kathy, I want to ask you about it. I mean, we saw the photograph, the gunman, a Turkish policeman, holding the pistol in the air over the body of the fallen Russian ambassador, shouting, God is great, and don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria. Alo Akbar there, and here the New York Times spoke with Borhan Özbilic. He was an AP photographer who witnessed the whole thing, talking about the shooter.
He warned people to go away or to leave. We left, but from far before I left the floor, I look, he shot again from close range on the body of ambassador.
Kathy Gelsonen with The Atlantic. All right, if we look back a year, there was the shoot down of a Russian jet and really frosty relations between Russia and Turkey. Since, a lot of warming, as Turkish leader Erdogan and Putin have seemed to patch things up. Where does this killing leave relations between these two? And how does it factor into this very, very roiling picture of that region, Kathy?
Right. It certainly takes place amid a backdrop of warming relations between Turkey and Russia. But there is this fundamental tension here, which is that Turkey and Russia are working together and have been working together on the evacuation of Aleppo this week, even while backing opposite sides in Syria's civil war. President Erdogan went on record very early saying Assad must go. Obviously, Vladimir Putin's intervention in the Syrian conflict has been pretty no holds barred in support of his Syrian ally. And so many people were interpreting the assassin's shouting as sort of a revenge attack for the horror that's been taking place in Aleppo, especially over the past few weeks. Now, both Putin and Erdogan have sort of downplayed the effect that this is going to have on their relations, and indeed, there was a meeting scheduled between the Russian, Turkish, and Iranian foreign ministers to hash out this Aleppo deal ahead of the assassination. But the meeting then went ahead even following the assassination. So that sort of is an indicator that things haven't been derailed. Again, at his news conference this morning, Putin said that the assassination wouldn't derail the improving relations between Russia and Turkey, but also said that it indicated the fact that it was perpetrated by a policeman indicated how deeply the Turkish security services have been infiltrated by what he called extremists.
And then there's that whole picture in Syria where we saw slaughter last week in rebel-held Aleppo, evacuations by fits and starts, and ultimately we're told pretty complete evacuation. It was rough going. AP talked with a Syrian opposition activist about that evacuation, how tough it had been.
We was waiting for a long time under bad conditions and of weather and lack of everything. I waited for about 3 days in the street, sleeping in my car.
Waiting just to get out, and it was hellish. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in his last news conference, he's headed out of that role, said exactly that.
The carnage in Syria remains a gaping hole in the global conscience. Aleppo is now a synonym for hell. As I told the Security Council 3 days ago, we have collectively failed the people of Syria. Peace will only prevail when it is accompanied by compassion, justice, and accountability for the abominable crimes we have seen.
Don't hold your breath. Kathy, where does this civil war now stand? With the fall of rebel-held Aleppo, is the country Assad's, or do we just have more unending conflict in front of us? What's the dynamic here?
So Assad now controls the major population centers on the western coast, what's called essential Syria, so sort of the spine of the country, most of the population and industrial base. And this is certainly a turning point in the war. The rebels had managed to hold on to eastern Aleppo at least for 4 years, despite, you know, very vigorous efforts to expel them, and it seemed to happen all at once this past few weeks that the city finally fell, when in fact this has been building for a long time. This was, you know, the city was besieged starting in July, and this has been sort of a tactic that Assad, backed by Putin, has used, you know, besiege the opposition, exhaust them until they're forced to retreat. You've seen it elsewhere in the country. You've seen it outside Damascus. You've seen it in Homs. I think what happens now, though, is not necessarily that Assad has control over the entire country. I think a lot of the rebels, for example, from Aleppo and from elsewhere have been evacuated to Idlib now, which has become sort of a holding pen of some of the elements of the opposition that Assad finds distasteful. So the question then is, what happens now? Assad's army doesn't have the manpower to wage battles on multiple fronts, and you saw that in the attack on Aleppo, when in trying to expel the rebels from Aleppo, Assad then lost the city of Palmyra briefly to Islamic State fighters. So they don't have the manpower to control the entire country. What I expect will happen is that the war goes on for the foreseeable future in the form of more of a guerrilla insurgency with various groups fighting one another.
And meanwhile, right next door, you've got American troops supporting Iraqi troops and trying to clear ISIS out of Mosul. What a puzzle. We're going to bring it home to North Carolina and more. Kathy Gilson, and please stand by with The Atlantic there in St. Louis. Sahil Kapoor with Bloomberg Politics in Washington. Jack Beatty, listeners, you can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a huge fireworks market explodes in Tultepec, Mexico. 35 dead. The booms just kept coming. In a farewell interview with Oprah, First Lady Michelle Obama talked about hope now.
See, now we're feeling what not having hope feels like, you know. Hope is necessary. It's a necessary concept.
The First Lady's view of hope, and actress Zsa Zsa Gabor died on Sunday at 99. She was well known for her celebrity social life and many marriages, 9 of them.
Marriage should be 50-50 proposition. He should be at least 50 years old and have at least $50 million.
Zsa Zsa Gabor with a long run there. We're looking at a week in the news. Nuclear bravado. The Berlin terror suspect killed. Aleppo has fallen. An ambassador shot. An Ebola vaccine. And bathroom bill politics in North Carolina. You can join us this hour. What is up with North Carolina and all the back and forth over gender and bathroom use? What do you think about President Obama's bans on Arctic and Atlantic offshore drilling? Will they hold up? Are the Trump kids getting it that they can't sell access even for a good cause? A lot of brouhaha around that this week. And are you ready to forget it all and head home for the holidays? With Sahil Kapoor, he's national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Kathy Gilson is with us, senior editor at The Atlantic. And Jack Beatty's right here. Been lots of talk about Russian intervention in the American presidential election. CIA saying yes, they did. The director of the CIA, John Brennan, interviewed by NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, warned against in-kind retaliation against Russia by the U.S. government for that hacking during the election.
I don't think we should resort to some of the tactics and techniques that our adversaries employ against us. I think we need to remember what we're fighting for and to engage in the skullduggery that some of our opponents and adversaries engage in, I think, is beneath this country's greatness.
Beneath this country's greatness. On the other hand, we've heard from the Obama administration that there will be some kind of reply to Russia. Vladimir Putin had his big annual press conference this week, press conference grande there, and was asked about the accusations of Russia getting involved in the American elections. Here's some sound of that press conference, courtesy of a YouTube channel called Trump Mafia. So I don't know, but it's Putin, and here's what he's saying about the Democrats. Says the outgoing leadership and the Democratic Party of the United States are trying to offload responsibility for all the failures on external factors. Russian leader saying the Democrats lost not only the presidential election, but also lost the Senate. Am I responsible for that too? Well, American politics right in the middle of the big Russian press conference there. Sahil Kapoor is there? Does there remain a real appetite on Capitol Hill to dig into these allegations of Russian intervention, or is it waning?
That's a great question, Tom. I think it's splintered. So there's certainly an appetite. There's a strong appetite among Democrats because the moral issue for them and the politics line up perfectly. They lost an election, a very close election, amidst these allegations that are pretty explosive, and they certainly want to look into it top to bottom in the party. The Republicans are a little more divided. You have Russia hawks in the party, and you have foreign policy hawks in the party, like Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham, who have joined with Democratic leaders in a bipartisan letter asking the Republicans who control the House and the Senate to pursue bipartisan investigations through a select committee. On the other hand, you have Republican leaders, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, Paul Ryan in the House, who have been very resistant to this. They know that the politics of this can be explosive for them. They know that this can suck up a lot of time, and they have a lot of ambitions for the first 100 or 200 days of the Trump administration. They also see their role in large part at this point to protect the Republican president-elect from, you know, what they have been describing as political attacks. And there are reports that behind the scenes, Senator McConnell has made clear to the Obama administration that if they do put something like this out, he will treat it as a partisan attack, and he won't give, you know, he won't play ball with them. So it's going to be a very interesting battle to see how this plays out, because you do have Republicans who I don't think are going to let up. But Trump is, you know, he's changing the face of United States relations with Russia already. And the big question is going to be whether he gets enough support within his party, let alone Capitol Hill as a whole, to go that route.
Listeners thinking about that relationship and more, Kerry writes to us, if Trump thinks Air Force One and the F-35 are expensive, they would be nothing compared to a nuclear arms race. Kerry on Twitter. And here Paulina says, is the arms race a feint to belie a Putin pal pact drilling in the Arctic, etc., the end goal? Still, he plays a dangerous game. Kathy, an arms race sounds like sword tips. But at the same time this week, we've had President Obama putting much of the Arctic, the U.S. Arctic, off limits to oil drilling, a bunch of the Atlantic as well. But we've got the Exxon chief coming in as Secretary of State, and Exxon, of course, wanted to drill in the Russian Arctic for a long, long time. Sword tips or pals? Putin pal pact?
I think my suspicion is that Trump is going to learn quickly about some of the underlying reasons that strategic cooperation with Russia has been difficult. These include, of course, things that Trump has indicated a willingness to negotiate on, including, you know, Russian intervention in eastern Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea. But it also includes some areas that I think he will have less give on, and the nuclear issue is paradigmatic of some of these tensions, I think. And so he's pretty quickly going to realize, I think, why efforts to repair the relations between the United States and Russia have foundered in the Obama administration. I think Obama, for his part, is trying to make moves in the waning days of his administration to try and bulletproof some of the policies that he sees Trump making moves to undo. I think as far as the Arctic drilling policy is concerned, that's probably going to be reviewed in the courts. So we'll see how successful Obama is in some of these last-minute moves at preserving what he views as his legacy.
Bryce in Flint, Michigan. Bryce, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and best of the holidays to you and
to
your panel.
Thank you very much.
My concern is, you know, we had this rather benign, benevolent call of make America or America first from Trump throughout the campaign. And I see that whole message being turning rather malignant, frankly, and bellicose. You know, the three big issues, I think, are Russia and these nukes, which I'm not that concerned about because we have this mutual assured destruction, basically pact, which I think will hold. There's Jerusalem and changing the embassy there. Again, I think that the international community will put the brakes on that, I hope. But what really concerns me as it does, I'm sorry, Mr. Lessenberry. Is Mr. Lessenberry?
I don't know who's going to put the brakes on a move to Jerusalem from the international community if Israel and Washington line up on it. I'm just not sure about that. But you raise an interesting frontier here. Jack, this week we had the president-elect weighing in on foreign policy on exactly this front, settlements in the West Bank and Israel. Egypt had put forth a proposition before the UN. It looked, I think, that the U.S. was prepared to support it, saying, you know, slow down on the settlements. Donald Trump raised the heat on that, and it seems as though that's not going forward. Egypt's withdrawn the whole thing, Jack. The president-elect weighing in well before January 20.
Yes, the usual custom is we have one president at a time, but that's not what we saw here, where there was a clear intervention. It may not have been decisive with Egypt. From what I've been reading, that was pressure from Israel, very strong pressure, that led to Egypt's decision to withdraw that démarche. But we'll see. And, you know, our caller raises the issue of the movement of the embassy and the appointment of David Friedman, a outspoken advocate of settlements. These are very, very controversial matters, which would, you know, they're really, if Trump this morning seems to be questioning a generation of U.S. arms policy, which is nuclear arms policy, which is to reduce nuclear weapons, here he's throwing into some confusion a settled policy on Israel, which is we do not move that embassy for the reason that the status of Jerusalem remains to be negotiated between the parties, and we do not appoint as ambassador someone who, well, really, according to what I've been reading, would be to the right of the current Israeli prime minister. An Israeli historian writes in the Washington Post that this choice of ambassador is a gift to Israel's radical right. This is a disruptive, if we're going to put it in that neutral terms. It's Trump being disruptive with Israel.
I want to bring it home to North Carolina. Everybody has followed, of course, over the course of this year, this debate about bathroom use. The whole transgender use of bathrooms got very hot there. A bill was passed. Charlotte moved to say to liberalize to that, and the state legislature came in and said no. Negotiations with HB2, negotiations that were there to let go. Charlotte would drop its policy, and the state legislature would turn off HB2, and maybe the boycotts that have emerged on North Carolina would be relaxed. But this week it didn't go that way. And here's Reverend William Barber. This is president of the North Carolina NAACP, again now calling for a nationwide boycott of the state after legislators failed to repeal House Bill 2 on Wednesday. He said a few unpopular lawmakers are trying to run a modern Southern coup d'etat.
Do not spend your money to further empower people who are doing what they're doing to undermine the people and to undermine the Constitution.
But you had the North Carolina Republican Senate leader, Phil Berger, saying Republicans didn't trust Charlotte, other locales, not to reenact transgender protection.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them. They've given us no reason to trust them.
So the law stands. You heard the incoming governor at the top of the hour. Very, very critical here. We've got a caller, Patricia, from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Patricia. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, sir.
What do you think about what's going on in the legislature this week? Are you happy to have the restrictions still on with HB 2?
I am, because anybody can dress up and act like a man or a woman, and they can be a pedophile or a rapist or a killer, a serial killer. And I don't think people realize the consequences of having a different gender to go in their bathroom, because you don't know, and they don't have control over all these people. Half the people that are supposed to be registered living somewhere, they don't know where they are.
Patricia, what about the boycott that North Carolina has faced as a consequence of this? There's been some pretty tough economic impacts from this. What about that problem?
Well, the people that were organizations and things that don't want to come here because of it, they need to think about the safety of their own lives, their children.
Patricia, but have you ever seen that actually transpiring, the kind of scary scenarios that you're concerned about? I mean, is there a factual basis for seeing them actually having occurred?
It already happens that John Walsh, his son, that he used to do that program on TV, America's Most Wanted.
Yeah,
this little boy was in a bathroom, and another man came out with his son, or he had molested his son in the bathroom.
I don't know if that factors into the transgender debate right now, but you've rolled the tape right back all the way to America's Most Wanted. Patricia, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here, if I may. Megan in Austin, Texas. Megan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
I think what you just heard from Patricia is part of the problem. There's a lot of fear and unknown facts about us as transgender people. We've been using the bathrooms for a very long time, and all that the GOP legislative bodies are trying to do is legislate us out of civil society. And part of what you heard from Patricia there was the fear that this will just allow a man in a dress to do some nefarious act. There are already existing laws and statutes on the books that criminalize that type of behavior. And I'm glad that she mentioned John Walsh. I used to be a board member for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a great organization based on the foundation of John Walsh's organization. I know John and Reve very, very well. Most sex offenders or people that commit crimes against children are actually family members. None of them are transgender men or women. And there is absolutely no evidence of a trans person specifically going into a restroom to assault somebody or do something. This is a made-up issue. This is preying on people's fears and prejudices about something that they don't know anything about. And unfortunately, we saw what happened in North Carolina with the GOP legislative body. You heard from Berger there say that, well, he didn't trust Charlotte. Charlotte did everything that they could do to repeal the bill of non-discrimination that they put in place. But the GOP legislative body took it back, and they couldn't even repeal HB 2. It makes it illegal for somebody like me who transitioned 12 years ago, who lives as a woman, who is actually in a relationship with a woman, to be able to safely and freely use public accommodations. And it's not just the restrooms. It's also access to government buildings.
Megan, we've got our time is short. We're very happy for your call from Austin, Texas. Sahil, what about the politics of this in North Carolina? Do they resonate beyond?
Tom, I think the HB2 battle, more than anything else, represents the last gasps of a culture war movement that is, by all indications, receding in history and receding pretty quickly. And that's not only because the country is becoming more and more favorable to LGBT rights at an amazing pace that nobody could have really predicted a decade ago, but as we're seeing in North Carolina, businesses are very pro-LGBT rights as well, and the economic boycotts we've seen, the fact that businesses don't want to be seen on the side of this is the sort of thing that will make it very, very, that has and will continue to make it very, very difficult for Republicans who still do want to restrict LGBT rights to keep going down this road.
But this week, Sahil, that's exactly what's happened.
And we saw the backlash to it, right? We saw the backlash. North Carolina, which has been dominated by Republicans for most of Obama's presidency, lost a governor's seat in part because of this. And we saw Mike Pence in Indiana, the vice president-elect, had paid a pretty heavy political price for going down this road.
We are headed to Charlotte, North Carolina, first stop on a national listening tour that we will kick off very early in January. And we will dive into the whole political situation there and very much looking forward to it there and more stops beyond in Detroit, Milwaukee, Spokane, right on around the country. Watch for that. Sahil Kapoor with us today from Bloomberg Politics. Thank you very much for being here, Sahil.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Kathy Gilson with The Atlantic. Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, best holidays to you, sir. Thanks very much.
Happy holidays to you and yours.
And to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.